Up to seven.
I may need more time than you, but I'll try to.
So if chapter six studied the changes brought about in us, because things are related to us, situations, people, and so on. Chapter 7 studies the changes in the things that are related to us, because we are related to them. In other words, what do we do through the recurrent interventions of practical sense, practical common sense, insight? We change the world. And so chapter 7 is about the changes in the world because of common sense insight and common sense lack of insight. Common sense knowledge is for the sake of making and doing. And making and doing involve a transformation of us and of our environment. And of us, not simply the way that was studied in the last chapter, how the individual subject is changed by his or her upbringing and so on and so forth, but also over history. The common sense of one civilization is not the common sense of another. The common sense of one age is not the common sense of another. There's a change that takes place over time. But the big thing in this chapter is how the environment and our Umwelt, the German sense of environment. Environment here not meant ecologically so much as just the world in which we live. How that is changed by the interventions of common sense insight. The practicality of common sense engenders and maintains enormous structures of technology, economics, politics, and culture that not only separate us from nature, but also add a series of new levels of dimensions in the network of human relationships. We're mediated to nature, if you want, through these institutions of technology, economics, politics, and so on. Now, a lot of these issues are more complex today than they were when he was writing this, but I think there's as I go through this, we'll try to pick out what I think is a kernel of permanent validity. It's certainly something that, again, I've tried to build on in my own work in terms of understanding the dialectic of community. The study of this aspect begins by discussing three recurrent interventions of common sense intelligence in human affairs. So that's section one, practical common sense. First of all, there is what we might call the technical intervention. And as things develop, that becomes a technological intervention. That's one intervention. And that you see that things can be done better if you create the tools to do them better. So mechanical arts, technology, capital formation, whether in a very basic sense or in a more complex sense, and of course that develops. For practical intelligence, desires are recurrent. Desires for food. Labor is recurrent. And the comparatively brief time, for instance, spent making spears or nets, technical intervention, is amply compensated by the greater ease with which more game or fish is taken on an indefinite series of occasions. So, that technical intervention to create these instruments for providing food, but it's a technical intervention of common, hey, if we put a net together, well, we just lower it and you catch more fish than you do if you just do it in other ways. Okay. So these technical interventions are themselves recurrent. Inventions accumulate, setting new problems, calling for more inventions, etc., etc. Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows 2000, you know, and no backward compatibility, different inventions that come along, but setting new problems, calling for more inventions, and so on. In correspondence with each stage in the development of practical intelligence, there is a measure and structure of capital formation. That is, of things that are produced and arranged, not because they themselves are desired, but because they expedite and accelerate the process of supplying those goods and services that are desired, that are wanted by consumers. This none of us realized when we first read Insight that this is a fundamental point in Lavrion's economic theory, which we only became familiar with in the last 30 years or so, that there are two phases to the economy. There's the basic phase and the surplus phase to the economy. And capital formation is part of the surplus phase. It's the formation of what will make it possible to supply the basic phase. So he's talking here about the intervention of intelligence into the into what in his economics is called the surplus phase of the economy. The creation of things that aren't desired in themselves, but that expedite the delivery of the goods and services that are desired. As I say here, this will translate into the basic and surplus phases of the economy of Lavrion's economics. So next then there is, in addition, secondly, beyond this technical intervention, there is the economic intervention in the strict sense of the term. So that's number one, technology. Secondly, economics. And the succession of new practical ideas, one after the other, calls for a division of labor, specialization. And as society becomes more complicated, this calls forth, it evokes, is the word that he uses in the book, an economic system. And this is what he means, this is a generic definition, if you want, of an economic system. Some procedure, not saying which one, they're going to change over time. But any complex society has some procedure that sets the balance between the production of consumer goods and new capital formation. Some method that settles what quantities of what goods and services are to be supplied, some device for assigning tasks to individuals, dividing up the things that need to be done, and distributing among them the common product, the vital values, food, clothing, shelter, so on and so forth. So some procedure, some system, some device for doing that, a generic notion of an economic. And the economy, in turn, evokes a political order because people will differ on those issues of how do you do these things? How do you break down? How do you assign the tasks to individuals? How do you distribute? How do you distribute the common product? Most of the political decisions, many of the political decisions that we make, are based on people's varying responses to questions that have system. The mayor's race right now is down to two very different positions with regard to the distribution of vital values to the entire community. But at any rate, the economy in turn evokes a political order. Each step in the process of technological and economic development is an occasion on which minds differ, new insights have to be communicated, enthusiasm has to be roused, and a common decision has to be reached. So there is the political specialization of common sense, and its task is persuasion and communication. There's a recurrent problem of effective agreement, and the political specialization meets that problem. So he's just giving you here three indications of the way in which common sense intervenes in human situations and changes them. It changes them with new technical and technological inventions. It changes them with changes in the economic system. It changes them through the political persuasion that persuades people to live in certain ways or to accept certain values or whatever. Okay. Now, there's a lot of work that can be done. And I'm not going to go into this because it's more in stuff that I've tried to develop. But in Marx's work, you have the technological and the economic translate not 100%. It's not a one-to-one correspondence, but there is a tremendous amount of similarity from the technical and technological over to Marx's notion of the forces of production. And what Lavrion here is referring to as the economic level is Marx's relations of production. And in Marx, the political will always be a matter of supporting the interests of one class over another class in the relations of production. The relations of production are basically owners and laborers, workers. And the political system is set up to support the interests of the owners over the laborers. And this, for Marx, is the basic dialectic of a social community. It's the dialectic of the forces and the relations of production. For Lonergan, in his economics, there can be this kind of tension between forces of production and relations of production and so on and so forth. But he has his more basic dialectic of community. This is moving ahead a little bit in the chapter, but I think it's well to situate these things. His basic dialectic of community is a dialectic between all of this, which is practical intelligence, or the fruit of practical intelligence, all of that, and intersubjectivity, the vital intersubjective level of human communication. That's the basic social dialectic. That practicality and intersubjectivity are in tension with one another in community. And the harmonious community is a community that gets them working in functional interdependence with one another. And a community in decline is a community that splits them off so that the practical, the systems created by practical intelligence are neglecting the underlying intersubjective relations among people, and there's an increasing alienation of people's life worlds from the systems by which they're controlled, on the one hand. But then when those systems break down, what you have is intersubjectivity taking over and claiming its due over against the systems. But perhaps out of that there can arise new systems that will coordinate social life better. So there's, I hope that's helpful, to point out a difference in the notion of the basic social dialectic between Marx and Lonergan. Intersubjectivity is not emphasized in Marxist theory. And in fact, in Marxist praxis, I think it can legitimately be said that it has been severely violated, the intersubjective level. Mao's breaking up of families, just moving in, and everything is without the social structure. Because when you break up the families, you send the father 1,000 miles away from the mother, you send the children somewhere else. It's breaking up the intersubjective bonds because of some creation of order, system, and so on and so forth, but completely neglecting this dimension. So, trying to locate this in terms of contemporary discussions, or more or less contemporary discussions. So, section two then begins, this number five on page one of chapter seven. Section two, the dynamic structure, begins by outlining how emergent probability rules human affairs. It's not in the same way as in physics, chemistry, and biology, but there is emergent probability also in human affairs. First of all, page 235, a quote simply affirming that there is emergent probability in human affairs. Human actions are recurrent. We all have ways of our normal functioning each day. We get up normally at a certain hour, we do this first, we do that next, and so on, and our days go on like that, unless there's something else to But human actions are recurrent. Their recurrence is regular. And the regularity is the function of a scheme, of a pattern set of relations that yield conclusions of the type, if an X occurs, then an X will recur. Okay? So clearly, schemes of recurrence exist and function in human living. No less clearly, their function is not inevitable. They can break down, and they can break down for different reasons. They can break down because we get sick. They can break down because we have had an addiction. They can break down for this, that, or the other reason. But the major difference in emergent probability between the human and the non-human is the following. That in the human, less and less importance attaches to the probabilities of appropriate constellations of circumstances, and more importance attaches to the probabilities of the occurrence of insight, communication, persuasion, agreement, decision. Let me give you here the example of, you may be familiar with Paulo Freire's book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Freire is basically in that book working from this precise standpoint that doesn't know Lauterbach at all, but this is exactly what he's doing. He's telling people in the book, he's dealing with severely oppressed peasant people in Brazil, and he's telling them, basically what he's communicating to them is, you think your lives are governed by the constellation of circumstances. You think you are controlled by that. You think you're determined by that. That isn't true. What's really important is you can understand your situation, do something about it. You can change the situation. The occurrence of insight into the situation, communication of insight, persuasion, agreement, you can meet together, you can make decisions, you can change the circumstances. It doesn't have to be this way. This is exactly what Freire was trying to do, was to raise the probability of insight so that people could change the circumstances in which they were living. The advance of technology, the formation of capital, the development of the economy, the evolution of the state, they're not only intelligible, they're intelligible, so we have sciences of economics and sociology and so on and so forth, but they're also intelligent. Because they're intelligible, they can be understood, as are the workings of emergent probability in the fields of physics, chemistry, and biology. But because they are also increasingly intelligent, there shouldn't be a comma there after the word increasingly, by the way, but because they are also increasingly intelligent, increasingly the fruit of insight and decision, the analogy of merely natural process becomes less and less relevant. It's not the same as the schemes of recurrence of the stars or the metabolism in the body or anything like that. What possesses a high probability in one country or period or civilization, high probability because of what's happened previously, because earlier schemes have set up the probability of later schemes emerging, they possess no probability in another. And the ground of the difference may lie only slightly in outward and palpable material factors, but almost entirely in the set of insights that are accessible, persuasive, and potentially operative in the community. What is this community capable of absorbing? If you want to communicate something, and any good communicator knows, you've got to start with people where they are. And then you bring them along to the point where finally you might be able to get across to them what you really want to communicate, but sometimes it may be more than they're ready for at a given point. So start with where they are, and the later insights can only build on earlier ones, and so on and so forth. So there are instances where there are things that can't happen unless previous things. Certain societies and cultures, maybe the previous things haven't happened so that the later things can't happen yet, and so on. That accessibility is various. And to understand the workings of any social structure, one has to inquire of many people in many walks of life. For the common sense of a people is parceled out among many and will never be expressed in any set of definitions, postulates, deductions accessible to all. So it's not like learning science again. Is that clear then, the emergent probability functioning in human affairs? But what's really important is, what's the probability that this group of people can understand this? And if you want to communicate something that you're hoping that others will understand, all right, what do I have to communicate first so that this will happen? The probability of insight, persuasion, communication, and so on. So Freire starts with the people, and he starts to just brings them through particular problems that they're dealing with, and then he catches them in the fatalism that they're determined it has to be this way. First thing he's going to do is, why does it have to be this way? Call them up on that, and then communicate to them that insight, that's really what he's doing, insight and free association and communication and so on is possible, and we can change the way you're living. You can change. It doesn't have to belong to this. Okay, sections 3, 4, and 5 are building up to this thing that I expressed before, intersubjectivity and practical intelligence and their tension with one another, setting the basic social network. Intersubjectivity and social order, section 3. The functional unity or dysfunctional breakdown of any social way of life. If you live in a community, some of you are religious, a number of you are Jesuits, and you live in a Jesuit community, you can think about that, or you can think of the student body at Regis. The functional unity or dysfunctional unity breakdown of a social way of life is a function of the interaction of the two principles constituting a social order, spontaneous intersubjectivity and practical intelligence. The primordial basis of a human community is and always will be intersubjective. It's not the discovery of an idea. It's people in their mitzvah, their being together. Just together. Primordial intersubjectivity to human existence. I was just giving the example to Dorothy. You're walking down the street and the person next to you trips and stumbles. You don't stop and make a reflection of that decision. You reach out. It's a spontaneous thing. You just reach out to do something. It's a spontaneous thing to do. The primordial basis of all human community is that being with, the being together, the intersubject. Not an intellectual discovery of an idea. But civil community is not just intersubjective. Practical intelligence is also creating these structures of interdependence, the economic system and the political order and so on. Structures of interdependence, schools, universities, newspapers, journalism, radio stations, structures of interdependence in the interests of the good of order. The good of order, what is the good of order? The good of order is an intelligible pattern of relationships that condition the fulfillment of each person's desires by his or her contributions to the fulfillment of the desires of others, and similarly protects each one from the object of one's fears in the measure that one contributes to warding off the objects feared by others. The good of order in a community is everybody working together for the common good of all, and not for the common good of one, or the common good of a certain class, but the common good of everybody. The good of order is not an optional adjunct, but an indispensable constituent of human living. We need to have certain orders, economic, political, technological orders, that feed us literally, really literally, that through those orders, it's not a matter of, people cannot live very long from hand to mouth. We're helped along by the fact that there's an order that allows us not just to have breakfast today, but to have breakfast as an expectation every day. That's because there's an order in place that makes that possible. And that we're part of that order and we benefit from it, and everybody should be able to benefit from it. And a good of order is one where the benefits are available to the entire community. So the good of order is, later on in this notion of the good, Lonergan will distinguish 3 dimensions of the good. There will be the particular good, I'm hungry and I need something to eat. Particular good for me right now is to have something to satisfy my hunger. The good of order, which is the setup that enables the delivery of particular goods on a regular basis, so that every time I'm hungry, well, I don't have to go out and sit on the sidewalk and beg. There's an order that I'm a part of, and so I have the means to satisfy. The good of order is the system or the setup that delivers the particular goods in a regular sequence, regularity. And then there's value. Is it really worthwhile? The level of value. And values will be distinguished into five types: vital, social, cultural, personal, and religious. So this whole thing is subject to a much further development as this work goes along, and some of this we'll see in this book. We'll see the particular literary order and value, and then in method and theology we division into the scale of values of the literature, and then I will try to spell that out in my own work later, further, and how this all relates to the dialectic. So, yes, Chris.
So does the realization of the good of order, does that pertain to the transcendental notion of the good?
Well, here's the thing, that this is what really pertains to the transcendental notion of the good, okay? You can have a good of order that the question can still arise, is this really good, okay? You can have an order, all right, that's delivering particular goods in a certain way, but perhaps not equitably to the whole community,
yeah,
or whatever, all right? So the question always arises, is this setup really good,
yeah,
okay? And that's the question of the good of order as a real social value, okay? So and criticism can be brought to bear on the order as it's functioning now, and transformative action can take place to make it work more equitably.
Because as it pertains to value, then the good is always concrete.
That's right. The good is always concrete.
But then, see, what I'm confused about is the understanding of what's the transcendental notion of the good. I thought that was like being was understood in terms of unity, and then goodness was in terms of understanding order.
The transcendental notion of the good would be differentiated out for Lonergan in terms of the five levels of value. That's how
yeah.
he would differentiate it. It's the notion of value. It's the notion, the transcendental notion of the good is what is expressed whenever we ask the question, is this really worthwhile? Just as the transcendental notion of being is expressed every time we ask the question, is that true? After me, or after what is, when we ask that question. When we ask the question, is this really worthwhile? Is this really good or only apparently good? What's functioning is, what we're revealing at that point is the transcendental notion of God.
Oh, I see.
So, we're living in a certain social system, okay? For instance, I mean, let's just use this as an instance. So we're living in a certain social system. We can go along, people that can go along for years, not realize that perhaps it could be done better, you know? But when that question arises, and when someone appears on the scene, whether when a prophet arises in the society, or when a Martin Luther King arises in the United States, or something like that, and then the transcendental notion of value comes alive at that point, because is this really the way we want it? Do we really, can't we do it better than this? Is this really worthwhile? And that question is the one that moves societies forward, drives some people crazy, especially the ones who are benefiting from the system as it is now. The transcendental notion of value is the most revolutionary force in the world, you could say, you know, because it's raising that question of whether it can't be done in a way that's more just, more equitable, more worthwhile. Does that make sense?
Very good, thank you.
So there's those three levels. There's the particular good I need to eat now. There's the good of order, which makes it possible for me to eat three squares a day. And then there's the question of value. Why is it that there are some people who are sitting on the street and can't even eat now, satisfy themselves every day? Can't we do it better than this? That's the question of value is emerging at one instant, one way. Is this the best way to do it? Can't we make it better than this? Yes.
Where does common good fit in?
Common good is a good of order that's really worthwhile. Right? It is one where the vital values, the ultimately it comes down to the equitable distribution of the vital goods, but the interrelationship of the levels of value will make it clear. I mean, I've tried to do more of this in my work than you'll find in the modern, but that's dependent upon the pursuit of social, cultural, personal, and religious life. They're all working together. We can go into more detail on that if we have time when we get to the discussion at the end of the semester. We might have a little time to pursue. Here we are. To push these questions. Okay. So anyway, now, section 7 then. So that's the intersubjectivity and social order. The two things that they're both. There's a duality. There are two principles constitutive of social order: spontaneous intersubjectivity, practical intelligence, and they don't always work together. In that section 4, the tension of community. There are those of you who are from religious communities have had experiences, I'm sure, of both types of community, where there's been such an emphasis on allus in ordnung, okay, everything in order, but there's no community, there's no intersubjective, or very little. Mm-hmm. And then there are other communities where it's a mess, everybody's happy with one another, but nothing ever gets done. Those are exaggerations. But you've got the tension between those two principles. They are grounded in a duality in us, giving rise to a radical tension of community. Intersubjective spontaneity and intelligently devised social order possess different properties and different tendencies. But by our very nature, we are committed to both of them. And we can't deny either one of them. And what, just as in our individual lives, we have to live as incarnate spirits, body and spirit together, not denying either one, even though they have different properties and different tendencies. So in our social lives, we have to live, the ideal is a community that functions well, that delivers the services, and where people are happy with one another, intersubjectively interrelated and capable of developing interpersonal relations, and so on. We are committed to both. Intelligence cannot but devise general solutions and general rules. We are intelligent, and so we can't enjoy peace of mind unless we are living according to the common good. It's basically what he's saying here, not just taking everything for ourselves and taking advantage of everybody else. And yet there's also feeling and spontaneous action with their home in the intersubjective group. And it's only with an effort, and then only in favored times, that the intersubjective fit harmoniously within the larger pattern of social order. Any organization, any community, any civic organization, any city that is healthy is one in which the intersubjective groups are fitting harmoniously within the larger pattern. They're not feeling that they're being excluded, they're feeling that they're part of the social order. Times are peaceful when the good of order comes to terms with intersubjective groups. Times are troubled when the troubled times demand the discovery and dissemination of new insights and the consequent adaptation of spontaneous attitudes. And this could be prolonged and extremely difficult. And so the tension is also a dialectic. And this is the first introduction of the notion of dialectic. It's one of the most important notions in the book. So let's spend some time with it. The tension is actually a dialectic. Well, what in the world is a dialectic? The term's been used by many different people and it's been used in different ways. Lonergan says the following, and I would take this as his basic notion of dialectic, certainly it's the one that I've taken over into my own work on theology of the dialectics. He hasn't taken it over completely, just as he is expressing it here. A dialectic is a concrete unfolding linked but opposed principles of change. So there will be a dialectic first if there is an aggregate of events of a determinate character. So the events that happen in social life. Those events may be traced to either or both of two principles. The economic order, people's intersubjective relations with one another. 3, the principles are opposed yet bound together. And 4, they're modified by the changes that successively result from them. So there's a dialectic in the subject, going back to chapter 6, he didn't use the notion of dialectic, the word dialectic in chapter 6, but now he's saying, you know what we were really talking about there? We were talking about a dialectic between neural demands and the censorship. Okay? There's the aggregate of events. The events in our lives are traced to either or both of those two principles, the neural demands that are coming into consciousness, the censorship that's either allowing them in or keeping them out. The principles are opposed and yet bound together, and they're modified by the changes that successively result from them. They function together. The trick here is functional interdependence, letting them both have their place. Social events can be traced to the two principles of human intersubjectivity and practical common sense. The two principles are linked, for the spontaneous intersubjective individual strives to understand and wants to behave intelligently. And inversely, intelligence would have nothing to put in order were there not the desires and fears, labors and satisfactions of individuals. And I would go even further and say that intelligence is not enough to satisfy us. Subjective communication and in the development of interpersonal relations with one another. Again, these linked principles are opposed because they have different tendencies. It's their opposition that accounts for the tension of community. And finally, they're modified by the changes that result from them. The development of common sense consists in the further questions and insights that arise from the situations produced by previous operations of practical the alternations of social tranquility and social crisis mark successive stages in the adaptation of human spontaneity and sensibility to the demands of developing intelligence. Or, on the other hand, I would want to go the other way, to the adaptation of insight to what might be emerging as from the life world of people as they communicate with one another together. And I think you have to talk about the relationship there being a two-way street. I think I want to say right now that there's been a long history in the Lonergan community of discussion on the notion of dialectic, and that there are different viewpoints on this. In Method and Theology, Lonergan has a different definition of dialectic, where he says it has to do with the concrete, the dynamic, and the contradictory. So, what here he uses the term opposed, but in Method and Theology, I think this comes up in places of insight as well. The term is contradictory. Well, neural demands and the censorship are not contradictory. Intersubjectivity and social order are not contradictory. So I prefer to speak of the concrete, the dynamic, and the opposed, and to speak of contraries and contradictories, two types of opposition. Consciousness and the unconscious in the subject are contraries. Jungian standpoint, the masculine and feminine dimensions of anyone's personality are contrary, they're not contradictory. Intersubjectivity and social order are contrary, they're not contradictory. They can function together. Good and evil are contradictories. True and false are contradictories. But there's a tendency if you reduce opposition simply to contradictories, then you're going to make one of these contraries good and the other one evil. And that's a real danger, I think. You're going to downplay intersubjectivity and put your stress on intelligence, or you're going to go the other way. And instead, what needs to be done is to emphasize the functional interdependence of the two. That's what's good. What's evil is the breakdown. Is that clear? I think it's very important to get that notion straight. I think in the Lonergan community, I came to all of this trying to get Lonergan and Jung and understand their relationships to one another. In the Lonergan community, there's been a tendency, I think it's being overcome now, to reduce all opposition to contradictories and to put the emphasis on intelligence as the good and everything else, sensitivity and so on and so forth. Not as evil, but as And in the Jungian community, there's been a tendency to try to integrate everything. So that not only, and these are the things where Jung is absolutely right, consciousness and the unconscious, masculine and feminine, and so on and so forth, the whole thing is get them integrated, make them, bring them to a vision and make them work together. But you can't do that with good and evil. And there is a tendency of the outer reaches of Orthodox Jungianism to try to get good and evil working together in people. That's dangerous, supremely dangerous, to try to reach a position between good and evil. But if we can come up with a notion where you've got two kinds of opposition, you've got contraries, where they've got different dynamic orientations, but they can, if you work at it, you can get them to cooperate together. And that's what makes for a healthy person and a healthy community. And then you've got contradictions. You've got what's really good, and what's really good is the functional interdependence of the contrary. And what's evil is their breakdown. So, and good and evil can't, they are contradictories, they cannot work together. So I think the notion of dialogue, or basically what I'm saying is the notion needs to be refined more than you'll find in any one place in Lonergan's writings. But he's pushing here in the direction that I'm trying to move in, because he certainly is not saying intersubjectivity is contradictory to intelligence, and you've got to go with intelligence and neglect intersubjectivity. He's saying just the opposite. We are, by our nature, we are committed to both. Right? So we are both intersubjective, and we want to set up an order to live in. We're committed to both. So he's saying the same thing that I'm saying, but using and to interpret him the other way is a misinterpretation. It's something that he himself could never accomplish. So the dialectic of community, then, I guess that's it. We've taken number 8. Do we have any? We're at almost 5 to 4. Let's do number 9 and then we'll pause. The dialectic of community differs in extent and in the level of activity from the dialectic of the subject. So the question then, how are these two dialectics related to one another? There's a dialectic of community and a dialectic of the subject. Okay, I'm born into, earlier we spoke about being born into a family and a culture and a social community and so on. I'm born into a community that is under this dialectical tension. So in a sort of heuristic fashion, you can say that there's a single dialectic of community, if you're born into a civic community, single dialectic of community that's related to a manifold of individual dialectics in each person. In this relationship, the dialectic of community holds the dominant position, for it gives rise to the situations that stimulate neural demands, and it molds the orientation of intelligence that consciously exercises the censorship. So there is a dominance of the community over the individual. The key to a healthy society lies in the mutual functional interdependence of the two linked but opposed principles of change. Or as he says towards the end of the chapter, dialectic rests, and this is a point that I've quoted over and over and over again in my own work, supporting my own interpretation of what he's doing here. Not contradictory. Dialectic rests on the concrete unity of opposed principles. The dominance of either principle results in a distortion. And the distortion both weakens the dominance and strengthens the opposed principle to restore equilibrium. How anybody can read that and then say that he's talking all the time about contradictories is beyond my comprehension. Because he's not talking about contradictories at all. The dominance of either principle results in distortion. Get them working together. Well, contradictories don't work together. They by definition, they exclude one another. Okay, do you have any discussion? Chris?
I had a little cough when he's talking about the intersubjective dimension and the social order coming together, and these periods of peace and halcyon, these kinds of times and whatnot. When my country is like the best, and like its ways are like obviously the right ways and that kind of thing.
You think that's what he's saying?
That's what he says on, then a man's interest is in happy coincidence with his work. His country is also his homeland. Its ways are the obviously right ways. Its glory and peril are his.
Oh, okay. All right. I see what you're saying. Okay. All right. Continue.
Well, you know, that's, well, just the notion that there can be an order of clearly defined roles, like you're saying with Freire, where these people are just kind of like, they might even be contented within this, which is part of the intersubjective mechanism or the deep-rootedness of this kind of, in other words, you have ideologically formed roles of complicity, which, you know, and it's like, yeah, everything's great, but, and then I thought of it in this like economic boom that we had in the 90s in the States with Clinton, where everyone seemed to be kind of like happy, but there I felt like it was, it's just, there was so much going, so much profit or whatnot going, that it's like everybody was able to excess. And like, we are having time because we're all getting fat. And like, whereas Jamaica and these other third world countries are getting exceedingly poor, but we don't see them. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Okay, now all he's doing there is describing the way people are experiencing their life. And remember that he himself has not yet introduced the notion of value. Mm-hmm. You're introducing it with this question, because you're saying that somebody's got to come along and say, is this really good?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's going to upset that easy equilibrium.
Yeah.
So I mean, I would accept fully what you're saying.
So what is, I guess then, just to be clear, in the context that he's speaking, what's his point with this sentence?
His point is that the tension is less disruptive of our lives when we're satisfied, when all the groups are satisfied.
Yeah.
Now, you see, the thing is that when you're talking about your country and my former country,
yeah.
You know, you're not talking about any situation where all the groups are satisfied.
Yeah.
And so the intersubjective groups are not all feeling that they've got a place in this. I mean, they're not. They don't feel that at all.
Yeah.
So, and that's what he's saying, that if they all felt that way, well, maybe we'll be okay.
Yeah.
You know, they're at least, and now, of course, today we're talking not just about our countries, we're talking about the whole world. It's inescapable that the whole picture is now global.
So maybe it would make more sense for me to read this in terms of not just countries, but like maybe more of church, school community or something like that. Or
yeah.
I can make sense of it in that sense when there isn't like an obvious distinction between.
Oh yeah, but he's not promoting any kind of nationalism in that comment at all. He's just describing what would make for a happy situation. Whatever that situation would be, it would be one in which the order is functioning and everybody's benefiting.
Yeah. Okay.
So
it's just difficult for me to, I try and picture these things and I just have never heard
of
it.
Well, we've never had it.
Yeah.
In our own lives, we haven't had it. But what is behind a lot of the political debates, if you've got the open kind of political debate, there is an open society where political debates are seriously carried on. It's basically, a lot of what's been happening in this city for the last month is the question of how are we going to get to the point where more people are brought in on the social safety networks that are in place, supposed to be in place in this country. You know? What's going to bring the people in on it? So how do we get our city, at least, to the point where everybody feels they have a stake in the social order? and where it's working, but it's working not just for Bay Street, but it's working for everybody. That's been one of, that is, that's one way of phrasing what I think is a major question most people are raising right now, anticipating next Monday in this city. How do we get everybody involved in having a stake in this and benefiting from the order? So how do we improve the order so that that can happen? How do we make it possible that we bring everybody in? But that's all he's trying to do there, is to say, oh yeah, what makes for a peaceful community is where both of these things are together. That doesn't mean that we've got too many of those. Mm-hmm. And now today we have to think of it. It's inescapable and inevitable, and from now on, there's no way of restricting ourselves to our own nation. Sure, we have responsibilities for our own city and our own nation.
Yes. The single dialectic community and the manifold individual dialectics are related through, he talks about being related, they're related through politics, economics,
yeah,
culture, society,
yeah,
those are related.
Yeah, that's really great. That's terrific. You've got that. That's the, ultimately, they're related through, I took it down here, but the levels of value. This is presented for the first time this way in Method and Theology. We've got five levels of value. Okay, the manifold individual dialectics are at the level of personal value, and the single dialectic of communities at the level of social value, and it's basically culture that mediates. It's the level of culture that mediates things. That's something that theology and the dialectics of history works out as well as I was able to do. But that's a big question. That was one of my major questions. How are these? What relates these to one another? And culture and the political is right in here. The function of a genuine political order is to mediate authentic cultural values to the social order, to the economic and technological order. Society. The genuine function of politics has part of its role mediating authentic cultural values to the social setup. But we can go into more detail on all of this when we get a little freedom from getting through the main points in his book, and I'm hoping that the last class of the semester will give us a chance to spell these things out. I have to be careful in teaching this because I've done a lot of work on these two chapters and developed the material. I've got to make sure that I don't get so lost in that that I skip over the one, which is the basis of everything. See you. Next week. Oh, no, that's for my own class. next week, those of you who are in the other class, you might, in case I forget to say it tomorrow, next week that other class meets here because the boardroom is being taken over for a meeting of some big shots. The other class, the history class, will meet here. But tomorrow will be the
What's the name?